Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the court. We have two cases today, but before we begin, I'd like to make two announcements. First, due to circumstances beyond his control, Judge Sparks is not going to be able to be here either today or tomorrow. However, he will be participating on the record. That means he is fully knowledgeable about these cases. He actually has asked that certain questions be asked on his behalf. He will listen to the audio of these hearings. He will fully participate in these cases at the judges' conference, and he will vote accordingly. The second announcement is we are delighted to welcome back to the bench Senior Judge Susan Crawford. For those of you who have not had the pleasure of appearing before her in the past, I'd like to just very briefly note her background. First off, she's a proud native of Western Pennsylvania, and in her professional career, she served as Assistant State's Attorney in Garrett County in Maryland, General Counsel of the Army, Special Counsel to the Secretary of Defense, Inspector General of the Department of Defense, a judge on and the chief of this court, and the convening authority under the Military Commissions Act. So it's an honor to have her back in the court. Thank you and welcome.
Thank you, Chief Judge.
Our first case this morning is United States v. Bogie. Lieutenant Commander Marinos, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Major Wiggins, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Commander Megan Marinos, and I represent Chief Bogie. Chief Judge, I respectfully request 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. The psychotherapist patient privilege applies to communications. The exceptions apply to communications. And yet, Chief Bogie was only provided with a summary of information. This was insufficient. And he was denied his opportunity to effectively cross-examine the government's primary witness. He was denied a fair trial. As such, this court should set aside the findings and sentence in this case for two reasons. One, the military judge erred in his misinterpretation of the duty to report exception to Military Rule of Evidence 513. And two, trial defense counsel was ineffective because they failed to raise the child abuse exception and failed to argue that disclosure was constitutionally required. Turning to the first issue, the duty to report exception is clear, and we need not look further than the plain language of the rule, which states that that privilege afforded between a patient and a psychotherapist ceases to exist when state law, as is applicable in this particular case, requires a reporting of certain information that was contained within the communications. Now, again, the privilege here is afforded to the communications, not to information, and that is where our opinion differs from that of the government and of that of the NMCCA and the military judge in this matter.
Counsel, let's assume for a minute that your interpretation of the meaning of that provision is correct. In your view, why did Congress include that in Military Rule of Evidence 513? Here, Congress came up with a detailed, finely calibrated privilege regime, but then seems to, according to your interpretation of this, hand over to the states, for lack of a better analogy, this nuclear-tipped torpedo that can sink the whole ship. Why would Congress have done that?
Well, sir, first, it does not necessarily sink the entire ship because there is a narrow tailoring portion to this particular rule. But in terms of why Congress enacted that, so if we look to the analysis, as the government pointed out in their brief, this was specifically to ensure that commanders had the ability to identify potential issues within the command, so whether there was something like child abuse occurring within the command. Now, as to the particular exception, Delta 3, where it puts essentially, based off of the government's reading, puts the authority in the hands of a state and their laws. We think that's inappropriate because Congress would not do something like that, or in this case the President would not do something like that, because they would not hand over whether or not an individual has a right to information to an individual state's law. It would mean each accused would then be subject to the whim of that state where the victim chose to report. So we would have, effectively, including the District of Columbia, 51 different ways this rule would be interpreted, which is why we encourage the court to adopt our interpretation of Delta 3, the duty to report exception, because that would make it so the communications that are not privileged here are specific to what triggered the reporting. Therefore, in this case, the child abuse discussion is what triggered the mandatory report in Florida. Now, it's possible in another case it wouldn't be child abuse. It could be domestic violence that triggers reporting. That's another common one seen in the states. So in this particular case, while we see an overlap between Delta 3 and Delta 2, in that it's child abuse, there is still this limited universe that we are not suggesting, as the government insinuates in its brief, or frankly says in its brief, that it would be all communications between a psychotherapist and a patient. It would be narrowly tailored to those communications that have to do with the particular trigger that brought about the mandatory report. So again, here, it would be the communications of child abuse. If, say, in that one session between CG and Ms. DeForest, there was information that had nothing to do with child abuse, the particular incident that was reported here, we're not suggesting that that information be turned over to the accused at trial. That is the importance of in-camera review. It is clear under the facts of this case that there was a trigger, there was an exception that applied, and unfortunately the judge bypassed that and determined it did not apply, adopting the state's law essentially as being the authority for federal law, and that is simply not what Military Rule of Evidence 513 was meant to do. It's not meant to make state law the authority. Never has it been that state law somehow becomes the authority based off of the language of a rule, and doing so here would be inappropriate.
Counsel, suppose the state law only required the barest notice, no information or anything else, but just to simply report, I have received communication alleging child abuse, period, and that was reported. Would that mean there'd be no privilege at all then?
Your Honor, the 513 Delta 3 would apply under those circumstances. And actually here, in this particular situation, the Florida statute did not require specific information be reported. It could have been as bare as Your Honor just described. It appears Ms. DeForest provided some amplifying information, which is really what brings us here, because that amplifying information is contradictory to the victim's prior statements. But it would still apply, and again, it would be narrowly tailored in that it would only apply to that child abuse fact. It would not simply be all communications between that patient and that psychotherapist suddenly are made available to an accused.
Can you explain what the word when means in the exceptions? You know, it's an unusual word. It says there's no privilege when federal, state, or service regulations imposes a duty to report information. Ordinarily, you might see a word like if or to the extent that, but here they say when. Does when mean if or does when mean to the extent that?
Your Honor, we would interpret it as similar to if. That's identifying the trigger, in our opinion. That's identifying, essentially that privilege is going to be lifted when this condition is satisfied.
Why didn't they say if they meant if?
Your Honor, I cannot speak to, I don't know the basis for choosing when over if, except for essentially what I just characterized as being this trigger. They want to emphasize that, yes, there is this triggering effect. When a state law says X, then we have this lifting of the privilege over the communications. So I think that emphasis on when is to amplify the fact that there has to be this trigger in order to release the privilege over the psychotherapist-patient communications. Turning further to the, again, discussion of in-camera review, that was at the disposal of the military judge here, and yet he elected not to conduct an in-camera review, claiming that Delta 3 did not apply under these circumstances. But as we've already discussed, it very clearly did. We had a psychotherapist report through Florida state law as required. There was evidence of child abuse. At that time, we have satisfied an exception to Military Rule of Evidence 513. And if the military judge was not comfortable simply collecting and disclosing the single day worth of notes between CG and her psychotherapist, Ms. DeForest, he had this opportunity to conduct an in-camera review. And that satisfies this concern about narrow tailoring and not wanting to unnecessarily lift the privilege over all communications. This is still respecting that there are communications that will remain privileged. And the military judge could have collected the single day worth of clinical notes as were requested and conduct a review. But he did not, essentially coming to the conclusion that the exception was not met because, or that the exception was essentially fulfilled merely by the turning over of the summary and the hotline report and audio recordings.
So based on that, what is your view of the CCA's analogy to attorney-client privilege?
So, Your Honor, attorney-client privilege is written very similarly. The language, as the court pointed out, is quite similar to the language of 513. However, again, in the attorney-client privilege, they carve out their own exceptions to the rule. And in those exceptions, they are, I would argue, much clearer and much more narrowly tailored, actually, than the exceptions we see under 513. The exceptions under the attorney-client privilege that are referred to in the cases cited by the court specifically highlight which communications will not be privileged within those exceptions. Just as here, the court has carved out certain exceptions. And so applying, we think it was inappropriate for the court to essentially say that, well, because we've seen them narrowly tailored here, we narrowly tailor as such here, which is essentially the conclusion they made. And we're not disputing that there needs to be narrow tailoring. We are disputing that there be this over-narrowing of the exceptions under 513, because the exceptions to the attorney-client privilege, when read, are far more narrow in just how they are written. And it's possible that that was done because the attorney-client privilege is considered almost this supreme type of privilege. It's afforded tremendous deference because we want people to be able to have these communications with their client, not so dissimilar from the communications we want them to have with their psychotherapist, but the attorney-client privilege comes down to the integrity of our system.
So if I can just make sure that I'm fully grasping the argument from your brief and what you're making today, is it your point that the issue of exception is an on-off black-white issue, and that the narrow tailoring comes in terms of the production of the documents?
Yes, Your Honor. While we understand each exception pursuant to the rules language should be narrowly interpreted.
So you do think that the exceptions themselves should be narrowly tailored?
Your Honor, the exceptions themselves should be read under their plain language, and the narrow tailoring should come in when determining what's disclosed. That is what the rule says under Echo 3 and Echo 4, just clarifying my argument. So,
I don't really understand that, though, because, I mean, if it's not within the exception, then there's no need to tailor it at all. It seems to me, in other words, you're saying, well, the narrow tailoring comes in, the judge takes it in camera and looks and says, if that's child abuse communication, then that's within the exception. But if it has to do with something else, then the exception doesn't apply. But that doesn't seem like a narrow tailoring of the exception. I mean, that's not even within the exception if it's not information about child abuse. I mean, it would only seem to me that you narrowly tailor after you already decide that it's about child abuse.
Yes, Your Honor. So, again, I believe I was inarticulate. So I agree that there's the trigger created by the exception, and then the narrow tailoring discussion happens during that in-camera review, which is
narrowly tailored? Give me an example of something that would be narrowly tailored where the judge would say, you can't have that, as narrowly tailored.
Yes, Your Honor. So taking these facts and manipulating them just a bit, say that CG had been communicating with Ms. DeForest as her psychotherapist for more than just this one single session. So say we had a year's worth of communications between CG and Ms. DeForest. Under Delta 3, that would trigger the privilege to be lifted over the communications that resulted only in that report under state law. So it wouldn't even be that evidence of any child abuse comes in under D3 under these circumstances. It would have to be the communications that occurred that triggered the report. And so the military judge would be able to go in and make sure that only he would likely narrow it down to the single day.
I don't understand that because even if you didn't have the narrow caroling, that would still be under D3. That would be all you'd get. D3 seems to have to go further. The narrow tailoring has to seem to go further than what you already have in D3. I mean, your position is the narrow tailoring is you just give what's covered by D3. And D3 is everything that is a child abuse communication.
They would also look, Your Honor, to whether something is cumulative. If nothing is gained by those communications, we obviously have other interviews with CG, whether it's with Child Protective Services, or there was a preliminary interview as well before her full interview was conducted. If it's merely cumulative of what's already in the possession of the defense, that's part of what is reviewed under in-camera review. And so the judge would not turn over something that was cumulative merely because it hit the trigger. And that is in addition to that is that narrow tailoring of what gets.
Well, now I'm confused because I thought you were articulating a bright line rule, sort of as Judge Manx described, where everything that fit the exception had to be turned over, and everything that didn't. And my question is going to be, how do we possibly apply an abuse of discretion review standard to that if there's no discretion on behalf of the military judge? But now in response to Judge Mag's question, you seem to be suggesting there is some discretion, and the military judge could decide that some of the materials that technically fall within D3 are cumulative or are otherwise unnecessary to be admitted into evidence. Which I guess brings me to the question is, then how did the military judge err here? Why don't we know that that's exactly what the military judge did in this case? He looked at the materials. He thought the summary was sufficient to cover the issue, to give the appellant a fair chance at cross-examining the witness if the appellant wanted to do so. It seems like we're just landing right back now at if the military judge does have discretion, we're just back at how did the military judge abuse its discretion here?
Your Honor, the military judge would be speculating if he was looking at merely this summary and stating that was sufficient based off of what was no longer privileged under the rule. Because, again, when an exception is triggered, the underlying communications are no longer privileged. The in-camera review is what gives the judge the deference to then go and ensure that no more than is absolutely necessary is provided to the accused. Now, if the judge had conducted in-camera review, given that Delta 3 was triggered, and determined that this summary is perhaps identical to what's contained in the notes, at that time, it would be appropriate for him to say, you don't get anything further because I've looked and it's purely cumulative.
Well, then, in the time you have left, the end result we had here, how was the appellant prejudiced by only having the summary?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What was the prejudice then?
Here? Yes, Your Honor. So prejudice, we look to the strength of the government's case, and here, both the government and the defense agree that this case came down to the credibility of CG. And what the accused was denied here was the opportunity to properly and fully and effectively confront her and cross-examine her with the fact that there was this inconsistent statement that there was attempted penetration.
Didn't the appellant know from the summary that there was an inconsistent statement?
From the summary, yes, Your Honor, but the summary is not the communications. The summary is
so what? Didn't the appellant have the opportunity to cross-examine CG on the fact that there was an inconsistent statement?
Yes, Your Honor, and it's discussed actually on page 82, I believe, of the joint appendix. There was a colloquy between the judge and the trial defense team about the fact that they could ask this one naked question, essentially, of did you say that there was attempted penetration? But they had no way of knowing the who, what, when, where, why, how of this alleged penetration. They did not have any of the amplifying details. And they also did not know how she would respond to that question because they did not have this information when they first were able to talk to CG prior to trial. they could not properly collect it from the clinical notes, which is what they had asked to do, which would have given them the additional details that they needed. But the fact that this is left as a bit of a question, Your Honor, and I see my time has expired, if I may wrap up your question.
Absolutely.
But the fact that we are left with this question, Your Honor, as to whether or not there would be an inconsistency between the summary and the statement amplifies the necessity for that in-camera view, amplifies the fact that the judge did err when he did not conduct that review and ensure that we weren't dealing with something merely cumulative and that the accused was afforded the opportunity to review that information. This was the primary government witness. This was their whole case. There was no corroborating evidence, no eyewitnesses, no DNA. It came down to her word against his. And so by denying this opportunity to completely review those records, whether it be under Delta 3, which was triggered here, denied him his opportunity to a fair trial.
And one more question. Can you explain exactly what is your theory, though, that somehow the result would have been different if only the court-martial had evidence of additional allegations that your client had committed child abuse?
So, Your Honor, it's not necessarily additional allegations. It's an inconsistent statement by the complaining witness and the government's primary witness.
But how would you use that to impeach? I mean, just realistically, I mean, how's the result going to be different, which is, well, you accused me of attempted penetration, but you didn't mention that later. But how does that, I'm just thinking, how does that, what does that add?
Your Honor, highlighting all the inconsistencies here, I think, is important to address this. So it's not simply that we have her consistently stating or consistently not stating that there was no penetration or no mention of penetration anywhere. We also have that at trial she described what legally is penetration in her testimony. So in addition to not being able to properly prepare based off of the sheer fact that they had consistent interviews stating no, making no mention of penetration or attempted penetration, they had this inconsistent statement in a summary where it's saying that he attempted to penetrate. And then at trial, she's describing what is legally penetration, and that's not on the charge sheet. The inconsistencies have piled up, and that's why it was so necessary to do the in-camera review and to actually collect the most accurate information that was possible to collect, the clinical notes, seeing as that's essentially what we're left with whenever we're dealing with these situations. But it is an unknown as to what would have been fully found within those records. And that does not mean that we are speculating here. It simply means that we knew there was additional evidence of the child abuse that got reported. We knew there was an inconsistency, but we did not know the details surrounding the inconsistency. And those details were critical in order to properly confront CG.
Okay.
We cannot
Thank you.
Answer.
Any further questions? Thank you. Ms. Wiggins?
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Crawford, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Major Clayton Wiggins, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Chris Blosser, I represent the United States. This court should affirm for three reasons. First, the military judge correctly interpreted the scope of 513D3. Second, appellant failed to carry his burden under 513E to compel further production. And third, trial defense counsel was not ineffective for declining to seek further production under a different theory. So turning first to the duty to report exception, Your Honors, the military judge correctly interpreted the scope of 513D3 to be coterminous with the corresponding duty to report, whether it's a state regulation or a federal regulation, Your Honor. Here, in other words, the duty to report exception in D3, we believe, does contract and expand with the corresponding duty to report. So here, Florida's duty to report required the child victim's therapist to report to Florida officials that if there was an allegation of child abuse. And she did that in the reports that Judge Hardy was referencing. Those reports, as my colleague has indicated, were turned over to the appellant, and he had what D3 requires, which is the information in the communication that was required by the Florida state law. Now, even if this court were to look at D3 and somehow determine that it is broader than what we are advocating today, we believe two points to that. One, to the extent that appellant argued at trial and in his initial brief before this court that D3 was a categorical removal of the exception, we understand his argument in his reply brief and again here today to have backed away from that categorical argument. But even if this court believes that D3 operates beyond simply the information that a duty to report requires, the appellant still has in 513E a burden to meet, and in this case he didn't meet it. 513E1A says that a moving party has to specifically describe the evidence that they're seeking and the purpose for which they seek it. And then after they do that, the judge is to determine if they have met by a preponderance of whatever that specific evidence is, that it wouldn't be cumulative, that they couldn't find it in non-privileged sources, or at least the substantially same information in non-privileged sources, that it would be admissible, and other the four tests that you find under 513E3, Your Honors. And so after that is determined, that is when we get to 513E4, which we believe that even if it's not an actual limitation, Chief Judge, on the scope of the exceptions, it certainly serves as a practical limitation on their scope. Because once a party, assuming a party, has met the E1A burden, then the judge is then required to narrowly tailor any production, admission, or disclosure to only those portions of a communication or a record that meet the requirements of the exception. That's directly from the rule. So to address the question of does the exception apply to communications or to information, we would point the court to the explicit language that Congress mandated in 513E4 that requires military judges to narrowly tailor any production to communications or records or only portions of communications or records. And it would be impossible to narrowly tailor to a portion of a communication if the exception applied to the entirety of it. Here,
so just, I want to make sure I understand. So in terms of the plainness of this language,
yes, Your Honor.
Clearly appellant's counsel believes the language is plain. We have a different interpretation of the language, but do you believe this language is plain?
We do, Your Honor, believe that Rule 513, that the language plainly limits the exceptions to those portions of the communications to which the exception applies, which here would be information.
So we don't need to have an overlay of the narrow tailoring to the extent of the exception. You're agreeing with appellant's counsel that the narrow tailoring only applies to the production of the documents.
That's right, Your Honor. And it has a practical effect it informs, rather, our understanding of what is meant or what is covered by the exceptions. If I can say that differently, it informs our understanding of what the exceptions apply to. Because if a military judge is able to narrowly tailor a production to only a portion of a communication, then it follows logically that it could be that an exception applies only to a portion of a communication, which we read to be synonymous with information or evidence, which is the words that the 513E subsection describe. But also, Your Honors, I'd like to point out that if there's any confusion about the plain language of 513 and that the exceptions apply narrowly to only that information that they pretend to accept, we would direct this court to look, as Your Honors were discussing, at the attorney-client privilege in MRE 502. Now, my co-counsel said that 502 is far more narrowly tailored than 513. But if Your Honors look at for example, the crime fraud exception in 513 and the crime fraud exception in 502, you'll find that they are verbatim exactly the same. And there's a few cases that the lower court cited, older cases from this court's predecessor, Rhea, Morelli, and May. Those are in the lower court's opinion. But each of those support the proposition that an attorney-client crime fraud exception, an attorney-client privilege is crime fraud exception, applies narrowly. And if that's true in those cases, and if that's true, as I believe my colleague has indicated correctly today, that it is very narrow in 502, it stands to reason that the exact same language in 513 must operate the same way. And we know from, as we briefed extensively for this court's cases in McPherson and Sager and other statutory interpretation cases, that it's fair to look at the context of the language at issue in the broader context of the statute, or in this case, the MREs.
Counsel, can you address the question that I asked appellant's counsel about why does D3 say when federal, state, or service regulations imposes a duty to report as opposed to the extent that it requires a duty to report? I mean, your interpretation seems to be consistent with when means to the extent that, but they didn't say that. They said when.
Well, Your Honor, so there are parts of a rule like 513 that are so long that they could be perhaps more clearly written, but when is the exact language that is used in the crime fraud exception. So to the extent that the if, if is the language that's used for the crime fraud exception. So to the extent that there's a question there, we believe that the same case law that interprets if in the 502 context could carry over, and that same word would do the same work in D3, meaning that D3 would be narrowly tailored, rather would only apply to that information in the communication. So, but again, expanding our aperture outside of just D3 and looking at the entirety of the rule, we believe that it's abundantly clear that it applies only to that information. But again, back to my second point, Your Honors.
Could I just follow up on what Judge Maggs is saying then? So it's your argument that because in another context, if was used, and here, when was used, if wasn't intended, when was intended in terms of the context of to the extent that.
So if I understand your question, Chief Judge, I'm not sure that there's a practical difference here in D3. It says when a state law duty to report requires information be reported.
Well, going back to clarify, what Judge Maggs is pointing out is when that term when could be viewed as meaning if or to the extent that. That can have very different meanings in this context. I thought your point was in a different MRE, they use the word if. Therefore, the fact that they're using the word when here means that it was intended to be to the extent that. Did I misunderstand your argument?
No, that's correct, Your Honor. But we're saying that in 513 D5, it also uses the word if, and we don't see a meaningful distinction between the two. But if I'm missing the question, I apologize. We do believe, though, that regardless of what the scope of those exceptions are in 513 D, when looked at in isolation, that there is a practical, if nothing else, a practical limitation on their scope in 513 E. And the facts here, the military judge did not abuse his discretion by determining that, and this is at Joint Appendix 338, that the appellant had failed to meet his burden for further production. He found that all the information that Florida had required reported was reported and given to the appellant. Appellant has not specified or described specifically, as he must, in 513 E1A, what other information he wants in the communications. And that's a threshold matter that does the work that a privilege is intended to do. It protects the privileged communications, and it allows for disclosure in only certain narrow circumstances.
Can you explain how that would work, given that they haven't seen the communications? I mean, just in a hypothetical situation, how would you describe, you've got a privileged communication, you want to find out more, you know, that something's been reported to the state, you want to find out more, possibly just to find out whether there's something inconsistent. I mean, would it be enough just to say, I want to find out whether the victim or alleged victim has said anything inconsistent?
That would be perfectly reasonable to request, Your Honor, but it would go more towards discovery, and that in a way conflates, as the Acosta Court below at the Army CCA discussed at length, that there is a tendency for practitioners to sometimes conflate discovery with privilege. And the law of privilege, as the Supreme Court said in Schaeffer and Senior Judge Crawford in her dissenting opinion at this court, said that privilege operates often to keep relevant evidence excluded from a trial. It does that by its very nature. And also, in this court said in Custis, that it is for the policymaking branches to determine when a privilege against the it exceeds its function and the truth-seeking function. So to answer your question, Your Honor, yes, it's perfectly reasonable for someone to want to, for an accused to want to know what their victim said to their therapist, but privilege operates to keep that out, absent some type of specific description of what they're looking for. It would work this way, Your Honor, hypothetically, if a victim had told their friend that they told their therapist perhaps described child abuse that had happened to them, that they had described all the ways that an accused had abused them, and then under a duty to report exception, that therapist reports just the simple requirements of the state, whatever they might be. Now, if that victim were somehow later incapacitated and unable to go through a forensic interview, as this victim did, or unable to testify and subject herself to cross-examination, as this victim did, then it could be that under the D2 exception, there would be a specific description of what had happened, or at least there would be evidence specific enough to meet the burden. But here, there's no statement in the record that indicates there's anything else in her privileged records that would be subject to an exception. The duty to report exception has been met, and anything, if I could move over to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
I have one question before you do, counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
In your interpretation of the rule, let's go back to the hypothetical that Judge Maggs had, where say the state requires nothing more than a report that says, in my course of treatment of A, I received information that suggests she was sexually abused by B. Right? That's all they have to report. No more details than that. In that state, under your interpretation of the rule, what would the military judge be required to admit into evidence related to that accusation from the therapist?
Yes, Your Honor. Under D3, only the information the state required. Just as if a state had no duty to report at all, which is a possibility, there's no constitutional requirement that a state had that. So if a state tomorrow decides to do away with their duty to report exception, then the answer would be zero. They would get nothing. If there was a limited disclosure, as Your Honor's hypothetical poses, then it would be only to the extent that state required information be reported. And here I would also like to point out there's no dispute that Florida didn't receive what its law intended for it to receive. No one has disputed that fact. So we know from the record that the appellant received everything that Florida required under its duty to report, and that meets the D3 exception. But again, even if it doesn't, even if it's somehow broader, the appellant has failed to show under D3, or rather under 513E, that there's anything else out there.
And now, quickly, would the military judge, in that scenario where there's nothing more required, would the military judge still have discretion to allow more evidence in if he thought that was necessary to give the appellant, or the accused in this sense, the opportunity for effective cross-examination?
No, Your Honor, because 513E specifically puts the burden on the moving party, and it doesn't say that anyone else can do that. Now, it certainly is the judge's prerogative and obligation under 513E to evaluate what the appellant has put forward and determine if it meets by a preponderance of the evidence those different tests in 513E3, Your Honor. But he wouldn't have a sua sponte duty to do that. And again, in Custis, this court pointed out that once the policymaking branches have determined how a privilege is going to work, then it's not the military court's realm to go in and question that, Your Honor, assuming that it's not unconstitutional, which, as we briefed here, 513 passes the Schaeffer test, and we believe there's no question that it is a constitutional rule as applied to appellant in general. So to quickly also piggyback, Your Honor, on the question about the scope of 513D, appellant seems to suggest that it could be limited to one day, but really announces no or offers this court no limiting principle as to why would it be, if it were a categorical removal of the privilege or somehow broader than what the rule itself says, only the information required, there's no limiting principle to say that it would be one day or one week or one year. We've not heard one, at least. And so, again, the plain language, especially when read alongside other rules, indicates, Your Honors, that it is only a narrowly tailored operation that discloses information only covered in the privileges. And to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, Your Honor, for the D2 exception, we'd just like to point out that in addition to failing to carry that burden for further production, the only evidence of child abuse that we have in the case, which is quite extensive, it was discussed at the forensic interview. The appellant was given discovery, as you can see in their motions, in the joint appendix, the sealed version. There's plenty of discovery about the allegations. The victim was cross-examined, as Your Honor discussed, at length about that child abuse evidence. She was even, her inconsistent statements were alleged by the accused. And if you look at joint appendix 143 to 190, that's the cross-examination where the appellant cross-examined her and questioned her credibility on two fronts, on the number of people that were actually in the home the summer that she was abused, and also questioned her on the number of times that she was abused, saying that she had changed that number throughout some of her statements.
Counsel, do you disagree with appellant's interpretation, though, of the D2 exception, that any communications about child abuse are just not privileged at all, and that the government, the accused, anybody can get that information?
We agree with the first part that the exception applies to evidence of child abuse. We do, Your Honor. We disagree, at least with the proposition, that automatically means that an accused receives all of the privileged records of his victim. Why? Again, going back to 513E. Evidence of child abuse could exist in a privileged communication if a moving party is unable to meet their burden under 513E and show a judge by the preponderance of the evidence that exists, that it's not cumulative, that they couldn't have received it from unprivileged sources or substantially the same information from unprivileged sources. If a moving party is unable to meet those burdens, Your Honor, then that's why I say 513E has the practical effect of limiting the scope of the privileges if it doesn't have the actual effect. And I would like to touch briefly, Judge Max, on the question that you had about, at the end of the day, what was the appellant to do with this information? And we'd like to point the court to the Bell against Watkins case from the Fifth Circuit that we cite. And the court pointed out there a proposition that we think is apt in this case as well. At the end of the day, the appellant, talking about prejudice, did have the chance to cross-examine the witness, the victim. Appellant did have a chance to question her credibility and to call it, and then argue that in closing arguments as we briefed. But as in Bell, we believe the same applies here, that the tactical decision not to ask an appellant if he committed other misconduct or if he also attempted to penetrate, that seems to be at least under an IEC standard or the prejudice standard of harmlessness to be a perfectly reasonable choice by the trial defense counsel, not to pursue a line of questioning that doesn't even on its face appear to help the appellant's case. So Bell v. Watkins tells us that. And then back to the ineffective assistance of counsel claims, Your Honors, we'd just like to also point this court towards United States v. Green, which talks about a similar case, a similar fact pattern that was resolved on the prejudice prong. But when reading these cases, Green, Custis, and a lot of these cases that talk about 513 law, Your Honors, we'd also like to point out to the court that it is important that 2015, that is when Congress mandated and then later the President implemented 513E. This 513E1A requirement that I'm discussing and 513E4, that's important because to the extent that any of those cases prior to that come out differently, we have to consider would an appellant in those cases have met their burden like they have to today.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
First and foremost, Your Honors, this is not discovery. This was not a fishing expedition. There was evidence that those communications that were not turned over to the accused contained evidence of child abuse that prompted a report through Florida state law. We knew that this evidence existed. There was not speculation. This was not a guess. This was not a shot in the dark. This is not Acosta, where they were seeking evidence of an absence of a discussion of child abuse, essentially to say, we want to look at the mental health records so we can see that there is no discussion of child abuse. That is completely an opposite to this case. Further, on the notion of prejudice, it's important to emphasize that this was CG's first full telling of her story. That is what is contained within the communications between CG and Mr. Forrest. Prior to that, she had made vague statements to her mother and vague statements to a guidance counselor. The first time she ever details what happened to her was in that meeting with Mr. Forrest. And we know that because the report demonstrates that details were provided, details that had not been provided to the guidance counselor or her mother. This is where she made her first true report. That is critical to give that information to an accused so that he can properly cross-examine and confront that witness, the primary witness in a he said, she said case. He was not afforded that opportunity. And assuming this court disagrees with appellant's interpretation of Delta 3, trial defense counsel was ineffective because under Delta 2, the child abuse exception was obviously, if I may briefly conclude, Your Honor.
Yes, briefly.
The child abuse exception was obviously triggered here. And we do not disagree with the government in that it has to be then properly tailored under the in-camera review process. The rule provides a process that could have been followed here. And had the military judge been provided with the opportunity to review this under Delta 2, if the trial defense counsel had bothered to raise that exception, he certainly would have met the prongs that required and prompted in-camera review here, and we would have had that.
I have one question. Counsel, I want to make sure I understand your argument. Is it your argument that the judge abused his discretion by not conducting the in-camera review?
Yes, Your Honor. So it's twofold, Your Honor. The military judge abused his discretion because he misinterpreted the Delta 3 duty to report exception, which in turn resulted in him not conducting the in-camera review.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides. The court will stand in recess until 10:45.